The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library. My name is James Peterson. I am the Director of Africana Studies at Lehigh University, and I'm also an MSNBC contributor. And I want to thank Andy and all the Free Library staff for inviting me to introduce this young man. I'm very excited about his work and very excited about this opportunity. M.K. Asante is one of Philadelphia's sons, one of our brightest sons, and we should be here to support him and encourage him. His first book, It's Bigger Than Hip Hop, is an incredible book where he establishes himself as a very, very powerful voice in the cultural critical arena. And I've taught that book in multiple syllabi across different universities. And he really shows us that, you know, we talk a lot about hip hop and we talk a lot about youth culture, but sometimes we need to hear it directly from young people. But tonight we're here to think about and to engage him around his latest book, which is a memoir entitled Buck. And MK, who now lives in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I went to Duke, so I love that region of the country, and it's a great place to live and to think. And I think this book is reflective of that space that he's created for himself to do the work that he does now. And if you have not read it yet, I won't spoil it for you, but it is a powerful memoir that chronicles his upbringing. And those of you who are familiar with his father, Molefe Asante, you can imagine the generational tensions in coming up in the household of parents who were so powerful and so thoughtful. But the book is also a love affair with him and his brother. And you know, in a world where a lot of black popular culture is emotionless, M.K. Asante has the courage of his convictions to articulate and express sincere emotion and sibling love, and it's very, very powerful in that way. Also, for all the hip-hop heads out there, one of the things that M.K. does in this book that's absolutely amazing is he tracks the pacing of the narrative through different quotes from different hip-hop songs. So what he does is he kind of weaves this sort of intertextual narrative between his own story, his own experiences, and the quotes and the energy of hip-hop culture. And so as you read through, you'll find yourself, where was I at when that particular song came out? And what did I think about that particular quote? It's an amazing text in that scene. So I'll stop gushing about the text, but I hope that you all purchase it. I hope you enjoy it and read it, and I'm sure his rendering of it today will give you the greatest sense of his powerful voice. Now, before we bring him up to the stage, we have a brief film that we're going to show you, sort of a trailer for the book, so you can get a better sense of what it is. And I don't know who controls all that stuff, but you guys can start the film now.
My name is M.K. Asante.
We need more volume.
Writer, filmmaker, professor, and author.
More volume, please.
The fall in Philadelphia. Outside is the color of cornbread and blood. Change hangs in the air like the sneaks on the live wires behind my crib.
Buck is my memoir about the graceful survival against impossible circumstances. I was 13, and it was just me in the streets of Philly.
Young Buck, Buck Wild, Buck Shots, Buck Town, Black Buck, Make Buck, Slay Buck, Buck Now. They stand where they always stand, between the liquor store and the corner store, next to the Fern Rock Apartments fence, under the train tracks, and across the street from Rocksteady. My mom calls them the corner boys because they're always out there, posted like guards at a checkpoint. They hug the block, huddled and hustle, eyeing everything and everyone, everywhere, every day.
But I survived. Not only survived, I thrived. Blank page down in front of me, pen on top of it like a paperweight. The blank page is the starter pistol that fires and triggers my mind to sprint. I feel something I've never felt before, purpose.
blank sheet of paper saved my life. Everybody in this world has a story. Buck is mine.
Ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, I'd like to bring to the stage writer, author, cultural critic, MC, and professor M.K. Asante.
It's great to be back in my city. It's really just amazing experience to come back to Philly. You know, every time I come here, I just feel so much love, so much energy everywhere I go. So it's great to be back. I want to give a shout out to my man, Alan Face Money, who's all through these pages, who came to support me today. He's been riding with me ever since I was 12 years old. So I want to give him a shout out. And so, you know, like you heard, you know, Buck is my story. It's my journey. It's my memoir. And it deals with some really difficult times in my life, but also some beautiful times in my life. It starts when I'm about 13 years old. And I'll actually give you some, I'm going to do a little bit of reading tonight, give you a sense of how the book is written, how it starts out. It's written in the voice of me. At 13, at 14, at 15, at 16, at 17. It's present tense. I see my Creflo people out here. Yeah, you know, it's written in the present tense. And so you get that sense of immediacy, that sense of urgency as you read the book. I didn't want to write one of those books where I'm looking back and, oh, I used to do this. I wanted to actually put you in the moment so that you could see what I was seeing when I was seeing it. You could experience what I was experiencing as I was experiencing it. You could have the epiphanies as I had the epiphanies, right? And so you're growing with me and you see incredible growth from page one, chapter one, to page 272, chapter 45, right? And so you kind of see my arc and my growth. And I'll talk a little bit about that process because that was very challenging to write a book in that way. But let me read to you a little bit from the beginning of the book. Okay. And some of this you heard in the trailer. The Fall in Philadelphia. Outside is the color of cornbread and blood. Change hangs in the air like the sneaks on the live wires behind my crib. Me and my big brother Uzi in the kitchen. He's rolling a blunt on top of the source. The one with Tyson on the cover, rocking a koofy, ice grilling through the gloss. Uzi can roll a blunt with his eyes closed. He cracks, splits, busts. The Raw's crews in Philly are all three letters, he tells me. I read the cover through the tobacco guts and weed flakes. The rebirth of Mike Tyson. I'm not good, I'm not bad, I'm just trying to survive in this world. Awaken crews in a rude fashion, on the ass like Mike Tyson at a beauty pageant. I do this. I spit lyrics to songs under my breath all day, every day. The bars just jump out of me no matter where I am or what I'm doing. It's like hip-hop Tourette's. He dumps, spreads, evens. JBM, Junior Black Mafia, of course us, UPK, Uptown Killers, PhD, Play Hero and Die, Uzi tells me. He tears, licks, raps. HRM, Hit and Run Mob, EAM, Iriab Mobsters, ABC, another bad creation, he tells me. Folds, rolls, tucks. Another perfect blunt. That John looks like a paintbrush. John can mean anything. Person, place, or thing. Sometimes if we're telling a story and don't want people to know what we're talking about, we'll plug John in for everything. Yo, the other day I was at the John around the corner with the young John from down the street. We get to the John, right? And the dude at the door all on his John, not knowing I had that John on me. Man, it was about to be on in that John. You know, everybody from Philly, obviously, we know what the John is, you know what I'm saying? And that's what I wanted to do. You know, my cousin, Nakia, yo, what's up? I'm seeing all these people from the book who are here showing me love. But that's one of the things I wanted to do with the book. You know, I love language. You know what I mean? I love language. I'm fascinated with it. And I was always, you know, I always thought Philly, the language we use in Philly, hey, what's up, man? What's going on? That's one of my students from Nepal, came all the way from Nepal. But the language that we use in Philly, words like John, you know what I mean, are so specific to Philadelphia. And I wanted to, when I wrote the book initially, I didn't even define those things. I just wrote it like that. And then my editor at Random House is like, what's John? And then I had to, explain to him. So then I'm like, okay, well, let me add this into the book. And I also, the hip-hop Tourette's line. Every black kid that I, not even just black, but most urban kids that I know growing up, we all had hip-hop Tourette's, right? You know what I'm saying? We just walking down the street, like, something's going to come out. You know what I mean? No matter what we're doing, it's always, so hip-hop plays that kind of soundtrack throughout the book because that's how it is for young black men. And even when we get older, we're still doing it. So that's important. And then you also got introduced in that first line to my brother Uzi. Uzi's a huge part of this book. He's my role model, my hero. I'm going to read you a little bit about Uzi. Uzi is the color of walnuts and has a long, sharp face like the African mask my dad hangs up everywhere. His name is Da'u. My parents call him Da'udi. And the hood calls him Uzi. He's got a bunch of other names too, like some superhero. Uwap, Da'u, Uzito, Wap the Culture, Cool D, Pinch P, Big Oo, Bark a Lark, Drop the Miss Rhyme, Big Fly, and Stilt the Kilt. So my brother is this kind of larger than life figure. He's always been really tall, so he's like 6'6", 6'7", and he's just, real charismatic. And so my brother is someone who I always looked up to. And this is how it always goes. Me following Uzi in everything, everywhere, like his little black JanSport, covered in marks a lot, strapped tight to his back, koala style. Anywhere, any place. He does it, I do it. He tries it, fuck it, I'm trying it. He can shit, why can't I? Sometimes I even duck like him under doorways, even though he's way taller and I don't need to duck. I guess I just do it because Uzi's more than my big brother. He's my idol. I don't care that he's taller and older and smarter. I wouldn't even really know his age if old people weren't always bringing that shit up, talking about, you can't do this, you can't do that. Why? Because he's 16 and you're 12, they say. I follow Uzi to sweaty Badlands house parties that always end in crazy shirtless rumbles with everybody hollering, north side, north side, in the middle of the street. To Broad and Rockland to cop dime bags from one of the dusty bodegas with nothing but Bisquick and expired Bisquick on the shelves. To freestyle ciphers on South Street that the nut-ass police always break up for no reason. To crack on Jones getting off the L at 69th Street like, yo, shorty, let me holler at you for a minute. To scale the fence to watch Sad Eye, the Jordan of street ball, hoop at 16th and Susquehanna. To skate the ledges and steps at Love Park until we get chased away by the cops. To bomb the Orange Line subway with Sharpies and Kiwi polish sticks. And now, to joyride through Philly in a stolen wheel. Being with Uzi makes me feel invincible, like nothing bad can happen to us, like nothing and nobody can hurt us. I feel unfuckwittable. So Uzi's this larger than life figure, and the book really opens up with his arrest. 20 cops raided our house, kicked down our door, and they took my brother to jail. And that was like the beginning of the end in a lot of ways, or the beginning of a new beginning, a new reality for my whole family. One thing that hasn't really been written about a lot, I mean, we talk about the prison industrial complex, and there's been some great books recently talk about that and what it's doing, but the effect that it has on a family, you know what I mean, is tremendous. And I noticed a lot of people, one of the things about writing a book like this, even just today, like I did the radio today and, all the press that's coming out, even just with that, there's so many people that have been hitting me up talking about their story, because I find when you tell your story truthfully and honestly, then people have the same experience. You know what I mean? They're like, oh, yeah, I got a son and I got a cousin. We all know somebody that's going through all these things. So my brother gets arrested, and that's a huge thing for my family because obviously he gets taken away. And that's really the beginning of, his trials and tribulations with the law. He eventually gets sent to Arizona where he gets in trouble again out there. And it's just looking, real bad for him in terms of the criminal justice system. Once you get in, and that's what my parents always told us before all of this happened, once you get in, it's real difficult to get out, And so when my brother gets arrested, things kind of get crazy in my house. You know, my mom, she's a really strong, beautiful woman from Brooklyn. My parents have really interesting backgrounds. You know, my dad is from Valdosta, Georgia. He's one of 16 children. And, you know, he grew up in a shack, you know, really the size of maybe like a quarter of this stage. I've been there. It's just, it's not there anymore, but when I was little, it was real tiny, you know. My mom grew up in Brooklyn. So my mom is like city, you know what I mean? My dad is like country, you know what I mean? And so, well, maybe that's why they, you know, aren't together anymore. But anyway, but so, you know, what happened was it affected my mom a lot. You know, to see your son in the prison industrial complex, to see him in the system, affected my mom a lot. And she had already been through a lot growing up in Brooklyn, a lot in her childhood that I didn't know about at the time, right? And so she broke down mentally. You know, she's a manic depressant. She became suicidal. My mic. She became suicidal. And even had to be institutionalized. And so we were struggling with that in the house. Eventually, my dad also left the house and moved to Levittown. And so I had a lot of time by myself, unsupervised, in the streets. I used to roll with my cousin's older boyfriend, who was crazy. You'll read about him in the book. His name is Scoop. I said, "Why they call you Scoop?" He said, "Because I be scooping niggas' chins." I mean, he was crazy. This was like one of the craziest dudes I ever met in my life. I mean, but he was also really loving toward me. You know what I mean? He was crazy in the street. He did all types of stuff. I mean, this dude, you know, was really out there. But when it came to Malo, that's what they called me, Malo. It stood for Me Against Law and Order. It's also part of my middle name. When it came to Malo, he was protective of me. He looked out for me. And he loved my cousin, you know what I mean? And so it was a interesting situation. But I had a lot of time to myself, and I started to act out in school. I got kicked out of a couple schools in this city, and just really disregarded school. Wasn't really hooked up with this hooked up with this guy over here. We're both, you know, just not doing the positive things. I think a lot of what was happening in the house was affecting me mentally. And then just kind of being rebellious. One thing I started to do when my mom first went away, my mom had these journal entries that she wrote. And they're scattered all throughout the book. I used to sneak and read my mom's diary, right? So her personal diary where she's talking about me, my brother, my father, my cousins, my family, her. And I used to sneak and read this without her knowing. And it was my way of communicating with her, because for a while we didn't really speak, you know. If she was at home, she would be, you know, prescription. She was, you know, hooked on the prescription medication. So she was always in like this pill fog. And so we didn't speak. So the way we communicated was through me reading these very personal letters and these very private letters. And what was so beautiful that when I came to, you know, I got in trouble for that back in the day. In fact, my mom kicked me out the house back in the day as this was part of it, part of going through her stuff and reading her journal. And then she found out that I was hustling and doing the wrong things. And so she kicked me out. But what's so beautiful about it is coming back around to it, my mom, you know, when I was writing this memoir, I said, "Mom, I'm writing this book. You know, I'm telling my story. It's going to be raw. I'm not holding back. It's honest. You know, that's the only way for me to write. That's the only way for me to write something that's going to be powerful, is if I just, you know, am raw and honest about it." So I told her, and she said, "You know, I want you to use my journal entries." And I was like, "Really?" She's like, I do. And I'm like, "That's what's up." I mean, I wanted to use them because to me they help, you know, tell the story and illustrate what was going on. You know, my voice in the book is very fast-paced. It's young. You know, I'm a teenager, and so it's present tense. And so when you get to her journal entries that are interspersed throughout the book, it slows you down a bit. It gives you some introspection. It allows us to kind of, you know, think about the bigger picture and to kind of see a different perspective. And so when she told me that, I was really, you know, impressed with her and her courage and strength, because she's putting so much out there. I mean, in her journal entries, she talks about, you know, her attempted suicide. She talks about her addiction. She talks about her past lover. She talks about her crumbling of her marriage, right? She talks about all of these things. She talks about me. And she also educated me through her journal entries about her story. You know, there's so many things. Like, she has this one journal entry where she starts out and she talks about, I'll actually, well, I don't know if I can find it, but I'll at least start telling you about it. She knows I'm, she asked me if I need any money. And I told her, no, mom, but if you need some money, I got you. Now, I was like 15 at the time, and, you know, she said, well, how did this child get his own money? And she suspected that I was selling weed, right? And so in her journal entry, she talks about when she was younger, how she ran away from home, how she used to roll bums on Nostrand Ave in Brooklyn for change and all these things, and how somehow there was a connection between what we were both doing at that time, and it was about survival. You know what I mean? It was about survival and making our own way and being fiercely independent. You know, I used to tell my mom when I was 14, like, I'm a man. Like, you know, obviously that's crazy, but, you know, that's how you feel. You know, I'm a man. Like, just treat me like a man. So, you know, and that's why I chose the title Buck, too. You know, it's a loaded title. You heard in the trailer, you know, Young Buck, Buck Wild, Buck Shots, Buck Town, Slave Buck, Make Buck, Black Buck, Buck Now. Buck means so many different things, you know. On the one hand, you've got, you know, this meaning. If you look it up in the dictionary, it says typically fashionable and hell-raising young man. Then there's another definition. You know, that definition is a derogatory term for black men during slavery. So, you know, they would sell big black buck right here for sale. You know, that was what they called black men who they were auctioning off. And then just historically, it has a negative connotation with black men. Then you have the connotation in Philly, and just not even just Philly, but Young Buck. You know, they used to call me Young Buck. We were in Omni yesterday. I was getting my haircut, and the guy was saying, yo, what's up with the Young Buck? You know what I mean? So that's what we called each other growing up in Philly, as you got most of y'all know. And then there's to make a buck, right, which is something that also gets explored in the book, capitalism and money and just how that affects families, because I was able to kind of see different sides of the spectrum as it pertains to money. I went to private school. I went to public school. I went to one of the best private schools. I went to one of the worst public schools. So I was able to see lots of different contrasts between what money does and what it doesn't do. I was comfortable with my family at one point, and then we were not comfortable. You know what I mean? We were not stable, and my mom was on her own, and she was struggling, right? So I got a chance to see what that does. You know, the other definition of buck is to buck shots, right? That's why we call it Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. There was a tremendous amount of gun violence. When we were coming up, we lost, me and my friend Face Money here, we lost friends to gun violence. We're still losing friends to gun violence to this day. So that's part of the buck. Also, you know, to, and this is kind of, I think, the major buck in the story. That is to buck the system. The book ultimately is about when I come to the realization that me against law and order, Milo, and all the rebelliousness, it's not about being a statistic. That's not rebellious. You know what I'm saying? Rebellious is basically what I'm doing now. You know what I mean? Going against all of that. So buck, at the end of the day, is really about bucking the system and not falling a victim to the traps that are set up for us. So buck has, yeah. So I'm walking you through this story, and I'm telling you that, you know, my relationship with my dad during this time was not good. You know, I didn't want anything to do with him at the time because I was upset with him for, you know, leaving my mom, right? I felt like he left me as well. And so I kept my distance from him, didn't answer his calls, didn't return his letters, any of that. Just, you know, was on my own with my mom. My mom was struggling. Eventually, I get kicked out of the house. I end up driving, I've been living in all different parts of Philly, West Philly, North Philly, Southwest, driving to Texas with these guys when I'm not even having a license, you know, coming back, driving 25 hours. But the story kind of takes a turn. My story takes a turn. I'm in Texas, actually, and I get a call that my mom is sick, so I come up to Philly, and I go see her, and we have this really deep conversation. She's in the hospital at the time, and she tells me, she says, you know, I really want you to go to school. And at this time, I wasn't in school, and I said, well, you know, Mom, no school will take me. I got kicked out of these schools. You know, they're not trying to hear that. And she said, well, if I find a school that will take you, you know, will you go to school? She's in the hospital. You know, what am I going to say? You know what I mean? Like, so I'm like, yeah, of course. So She's like, all right, so my mom is so resourceful. Of course, she found a school. I talk about, this is a book about education. It's about miseducation, re-education, self-education, street education. You know, Mark Twain said, don't let school get in the way of your education. This is a book about education. And so I get to this school. This is my fourth school or whatever in a couple years. And it's radically different than any other school that I've been to. You know, I described one of the schools I went to looked like shit, like literally looked like shit. The other school looked like a prison. Two schools looked like prisons. Very small, I mean, barely any windows, you know what I'm saying? Metal detectors, you know, it was like, CFCF or something, you know what I mean? This school. So these were the schools. And so I arrive at this fourth school, and it straight up looks like a gingerbread house. they called it an alternative school at the time, right? Called Krefeld. And I get there. And I see these kids walking in. Yo, these were some of the weirdest kids I've ever seen in my life. And I'm like, this is alternative school. I'm not this damn alternative. Like, this is some next level, you know what I mean? So I wasn't feeling it at all. I didn't want anything to do with that place. seriously, I was just like, yo, get me out of here. But being at this school, it changed a lot for me. I was in this class one day, and this teacher that I had, she's actually here, Stacy, right there. She'll ask a question later. But we were in this class, and you know, she put blank pieces of paper in front of everybody and told everybody to write. And you know, I'm used to rote memorization, regurgitation, this kind of education. So I didn't do it. I just, you know, immediately I was totally turned off to schoolwork, all that stuff. So when someone told me to do something like an authority, I just never did it. So I didn't do it. And then she came over and she's like, you know, I want you to write. And now I'm frustrated. I'm like, what you want me to write about, yo? You know, I got my attitude. I'm all a 16. I'm a grown man. You know what I mean? I'm not trying to hear this right now. What you want me to write, yo? It's like, write anything you want. Anything I want. So I'm looking at her like she's crazy, you know what I mean? But I also know that teachers have always kind of said, you know, oh yeah, be free, we want you to express yourself. And then as soon as you express yourself, you know, so I wrote fuck school. You know what I mean? Just straight up, fuck school. And, you know, she looked over and she was like, cool, now keep going. And see, that's not how it was supposed to work. The way it was supposed to work is I write the curse word, you kick me out, I leave, I go hang out with my mans and them, and I don't come back. You know what I mean? That's how it was supposed to go. She kind of messed up the whole situation. So now I'm in here, and I'm looking at these other kids, and they're writing, and their pens are moving, and I'm kind of wondering, well, damn, what are they writing about? And so I want to read you a little bit from that section. I turn the page over. It's blank again. The blank page is the starter pistol that fires and triggers my mind to sprint. What will I write? What will I say? Will I say what I write? Write what I say? Something funny? Something serious? Something about my family? Something about Amir, Ryan? How will I start? Whose story will I tell? My story? Something made up? What about a story about a boy from Philly? A lost boy? Who wants to find himself, but doesn't know where to look. Who wants to tell his story, but doesn't know where to begin or end. Who searches anyway and discovers something about himself, about the world. I stare at the blank page, an ocean of white alive with possibility. I hear myself take a breath, then exhale. Whew, deep, like I just rose from underwater. It's like I'm at the free throw line again, foul shots. Like the game is on the line, again. I remember something my dad told me. Shoot to make it. My hand shaking, trembling like it's freezing. Then it hits. A silence louder than all the music I've heard in my life. All the light in the world, in one beam, before me. I stare deep into the blank page and see myself. I feel something I've never felt before. Purpose. I don't know what my exact purpose is yet, but I know it has something to do with this pen and this blank page. I am a blank page. Holding the pen this way, snug and firm in my fists, makes me feel like I can write out my future, spell out my destiny in sharp strokes. And so that moment there was pivotal for me, and I couldn't write. I was stuck. I froze. I didn't know what to write. I had writer's block, you know what I mean? And so it took me a while to be able to actually open that door, right? I said in the book, you know, the blank page lit up a room in my heart that I didn't know existed. There's a whole kind of whole part of my brain that I didn't know was available to me, right? And so writing helped free that. It helped me. It was the first time I thought, okay, now this is cool. This is something that's actually challenging to me, engaging in school. It's not just memorize this and regurgitate this, but this is something that involves me. And so I really took to writing, told my teacher, I want to be a writer. I like this writing thing. And she said, well, you want to be a writer, you got to be a good reader. And so she gave me a book. I started reading voraciously. And I really started to realize, you know, there were things that I had heard. What's up, Ma? There were things that I heard. It's so great coming back to the city because you see all these beautiful people. But, you know, I remember hearing all the time from people like my dad, you know, that it was illegal for slaves to read back in the day, right? And I never really understood why until I started writing and then I started reading. You know, we think in words, you know, oftentimes subvocally. So when you limit someone's words, you also, when you limit their vocabulary, their access to language, access to words, you also limit their thoughts. You know what I'm saying? You can't think about freedom because you don't even have the language, the tools to do so. And so I became, you know, that liberated me in a lot of ways. And I started reading everything. I started out reading a lot of people from the Beat Generation. That was what I took to first because they were rebels. They were outlaws. They were doing their own thing. They had their own subculture and they were against society and against the system. And, you know, they smoked weed and they were doing their own thing and driving around the country having crazy, you know, that's what I identified with. And I said, wow, I didn't even know you could write that kind of stuff. And then from there, I discovered other writers. From the Beats, I discovered people like Walt Whitman and other people. And then I discovered, oh, there's a black guy who was down with the Beats. His name was Leroy Jones. Oh, who's this guy? Amiri Baraka. And then opened up. And then when this started happening in my life, a lot of other things started changing in my life. Like, for example, my mom started to get better. And I started to see a connection between what I was doing and my mom's mental health. My relationship with my dad actually got better because of this. There was one incident. I was in the 35th precinct. Down Allenley, I got arrested. And this was after I was at Creffel. Got arrested. I was just the wrong place, wrong time. I was down J Street, of all places. J Street in the 90s, there could be a whole book about that. It was an open-air drug market, syrup, Xannies, promethazine, all of that stuff was popping in the 90s on J Street. So I was down there, ended up getting arrested, getting taken to the 35th precinct. My dad comes to get me out of jail, and he's pissed. You know, he don't play that. He's from down south. You know, he grew up picking cotton. He's like, yo, what is wrong with these kids? You know, he's not feeling it. And so he picks me up, and he's just pissed at me the whole time. And I'm pissed at him. You know what I mean? I got beef with you, too. Like, so we're both got beef with each other. And we're in the car, and we're driving on Broad Street. And he says, do you want to fight me or something? I said, yeah, actually, I do. And so he pulls over Broad and Erie. Right? Now, you know, if you know my dad, he always wears dashikis, you know what I'm saying? So my dad in a dashiki, we on Broad and Erie in front of Checkers. And we like, you know what I mean? Like, straight up. So, and you know, so we just start rumbling, like, right there. And, you know, he got me in all types of headlocks. And so this is all in the book, obviously. And it ends with my dad, you know, being on top of me, wearing, like, the hood of the car. And he's like, you know, I love you, boy. And he's like pressing those words into me. Like, I love you, boy. And, you know, I always remember I had a friend who got killed in Philly, and he's in the book. And, you know, he always, when I used to, like, not take calls from my dad and, like, be, like, real, like, not feeling my dad, my friend would always remind me, like, yo, at least you got a dad. Like, there's so many of us out here that don't even know our pop, like, all that. So that was always in the back of my mind, too, because my friend had recently passed away. So, anyway, he's pressing this into me, you know, I love you, I love you, I love you. And you know, I was in the 35th precinct. So after that, you know, Dwight Soul Food was right across the street. So after that fight, we went and got some soul food. You know what I mean? And, you know, and we talked. You know what I mean? It was the first time that we had talked in years, really, like, and really talked, like, man to man now, you know? He didn't even know what I was doing, like, the, you know, the writing and all this stuff. So I was able to talk to him about that, and he was able to talk to me about his decisions and just life in general. And that was really the beginning of our new relationship. You know what I mean? You know, Frederick Douglass, he says, you know, without struggle, there's no progress. And that's definitely been true in our relationship, you know, in all my relationships, really. There's always been that sense of struggle. You know, there's always been struggles. And, but because of those moments, we were able to get even stronger. And so, I don't want to give too much away. I guess I'm giving it all away, but the book, but I'm not though, because the beauty in this book, honestly, is there's so many things I'm not telling you. There's so many things that I couldn't cover in this amount of time about the nuances of Philly and the language and the people and so many people. You know, my education came from so many different places. You know what I mean? You know, the guys in my neighborhood who all joined a cult, my brother's friends who joined a cult and, you know, were telling me about the spaceships and all of this stuff. And all these people educated me and gave me something. You know what I mean? The bum on the street who told me, young man, do you know what soul is? And I said, Soul Train? And he said, no, soul is the graceful survival against impossible circumstances. You know, the bum on the street that told me that. I believe that the whole world is a university. And everywhere you go, like, we were in a barbershop yesterday, and there was a professor in the barbershop. You know what I mean? Like, there's professors everywhere. There's teachers everywhere along every stop. And you just have to kind of be open to those messages and those gems. So so that's the beauty of this story. And like he said, my brother's letters from prison are also interspersed throughout the book. Right. And so you get all these different voices. You know, my brother, when he first goes out to Arizona, is just a ball of energy. He's wilding out. He's, you know, he's carrying a Tech Nine around and just, you know, out there. You know what I mean? And then he goes to jail and you see the tone of those letters change. You know what I mean? I also have my sister's letters in the book. My sister is an amazing, interesting person. Right. And she suffers from schizophrenia and she has a really interesting form of schizophrenia where on the one hand, she does our family genealogy and she thinks that we're from like white people, like only like Welsh, Dutch, Italian, German, French. She tells me, you know, we're French, we're Irish, we're Welsh, we're all these things. We're Hawaiian, we're this, we're that. Never African, never black, right? At the same time, she sees and hears these people called the neighbors and these people are out to get her because she's black and they're racist. And this is what is tormenting her. And she writes about the neighbors are following me. They called me a black bitch. They said they're going to kill me. Da, 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 da. You know, and she doesn't get it because she's like, I'm mixed. You know what I mean? Even though, you know, my sister is the you know, she's Wesley Snipes black. You know what I mean? There's no doubt about it. You know what I mean? But she feels these things. And it's like, so there's all these things going on, all these different voices going on in the story. And that's something that makes sense. So he just gave me the, you know, the time thing. But that means we open it up for Q&A. So thank you. And yeah, thank you so much. At this time, let's if you have questions, comments, thoughts, things you want to share, let's do it. Don't be shy. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Megan Washington. Hi, everyone.
Hey, how you doing?
What's your favorite book?
My favorite book? That's a great question. You know, it changes, like, as I read new books all the time. But, you know, off the top of my head, a book that influenced me a lot was The Alchemist. You know, it was inspirational, motivational. I read that book at a time in my life where I was really at that crossroad. And so it gave me a lot of inspiration, motivation, hope. And I always, you know, There's so much beauty and simplicity. It's very difficult to write something very simple, actually, right? It's easy to kind of be convoluted and all over the place and da-da-da. But to write something so simple yet so effective and powerful it's an art. It's an art to it, you know? And it takes real skill. It's almost like an Apple design, Apple products. It's designed very simply, almost like no design at all. But to get there takes incredible innovation. And so that story to me. It's very simple. It's short, compact. You can read it in a couple hours, but wow, it's a profound book. So that's a book that I really like. I also really love the book Asada by Asada Shakur. That's one of the books that, again, I read it at a time when I was like, yo. And not only because I'm always, as a writer, for me, it's not just about content. It's also about, you know, your writing, right? And your style as a writer. And so one thing about Asada is she's a beautiful, amazing writer. And so the story, the way the story is told is just very poetic. And it touched me. It's one of the movies that I want to make in the future. So those are two books that stand out. Yep.
It just occurred to me when you were talking that the beat, that, or the hip-hop that you were talking in the beginning was so much like, was it Firman Getty?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then when you said the Beat Generation, I thought it all does tie together, doesn't it?
Exactly. Well. I mean, I was just talking to a writer the other day, and he asked me about that specifically, and I hadn't really made that connection, but it's a no-brainer. I mean, the Beat Generation, you know, for those of you who don't know, those writers, they were very much inspired by bebop and the jazz of the time. And so they wrote to that kind of syncopation, you know what I mean? They were very interested in what they called at the time free verse, free prose, spontaneous prose, where just like Monk, I mean, just like Mingus and Bird and all those guys would get up there and improv and have jam sessions with the horns, they wanted to do that on the writer tip, right? So they would get in there and they would write sentences that were three pages with no commas and no punctuation, you know what I mean? And they were really on this, and they were using the music and the beat as a way to kind of influence their writing. And when I write, I write to a beat. I don't write to music with lyrics, but I write to, usually, it depends on what I'm writing, but there's always a beat. When I was writing this book, it was definitely hip-hop. And so instrumentals, I'm listening, and it definitely has a rhythm to it, you know what I mean? And I'm a poet first, I'm a lyricist, so all of those things kind of influenced me, and even this whole notion of spontaneous prose, you know, well, spontaneous jazz and jam sessions, well, in hip-hop, we call that freestyling, you know what I mean? Just going off the top of the dome. So that's, I definitely think there's a strong connection between that. And, yep, let's go, Stacy. First creative writing class I ever took was with this lady right here.
It could have been anyone, honestly. It was you. So I guess what I want to say is, from the minute I met you, you were a very authentic person, right? You're there, and it's all you all the time. And yet, when you were at Krefeld, you also, in some ways, were leading like a double life. Because I think that many of us, the grown-ups anyway, had really no idea about the depths of some of the stuff that you were experiencing. And I guess I would love to hear a little bit about what it was like for you to travel to this school in Chestnut Hill every day and really kind of switch into school mode and then go back home at night and switch into the other, and what that felt like, and whether, you know, folks in the neighborhood knew about your school life and whether folks in school knew about your neighborhood life.
Yo, I got the greatest story to tell you, face. You know I got to tell this story. So that's a great question. So, okay. Couple things. First, I got to tell you another crazy story. So I took two creative writing classes at Krefeld, right? And it was with Stacy and then this other lady named Debbie. Now, the other lady named Debbie, I wanted to thank her because she gave me like the book, like the Jack Kerouac and stuff. So I wanted to thank her for putting me on as a creative writer. So I went to Krefeld one day. I'm like, you know, I want to talk to Debbie. You know, they're like, oh, she's not here. And I'm like, okay, well, can you just give me her address or contact info? I just want to let her know thank you. You know what I mean? And they're like, you're not going to be able to get in contact with Debbie. I'm like, something happened to her? Like, you know what I mean? They're like, oh, no, nothing like that. They're like, she is in Tibet on a mountain, completely no contact with human beings. Like, she's in a monastery. She wants nothing to do with human beings on this level. Like, I don't know. I was like, damn, was it something I did? Like, I didn't know because I was still not fully, you know, developed back then. So I was kind of thinking I might have been the cause of that. But yeah, she's, so I could, So they told me, they said, look, if you want to thank her, just continue to do what you're doing and be a positive influence and inspire other people because, you know, she's gone. And I was like, wow, that's amazing. So that's a whole story in itself. I was thinking that would be a crazy documentary, like trying to go find her in Tibet. Okay. Now, speaking of Tibet and Asia and the question that you asked, which was really interesting, you know, this double life, and did my friends know about, you know, that I was at Krefeld and, you know, my friend. And a lot of them knew that, yeah, like, especially when I was going to a different school. I wasn't going to Fells anymore. You know, they didn't see me around anymore. So I was going to this new school called Krefeld. And, yes, my friends did know. Like, for example, now this is the dude. He's in the book. Me and him experienced some of the craziest things Philadelphia has to offer when we were, like, young. And, you know, we grew up real fast and just, you know, there's so much even that's not in the book. We were just talking about this yesterday. We used to take cabs. We used to take taxis late at night, 2:30, 3 in the morning, and then just jump out and start running, you know what I mean? And we run opposite directions. And then one day, this cab driver put a gun out on us and started shooting it. I mean, crazy stuff like that used to happen to us, right? Okay, so one day, I wasn't doing my work at Krefeld. I wasn't doing my work. And we had to do some assignment where we had to, like, it was like a world history something. Whatever it was, I didn't do it, right? Because I was still not doing that in my schoolwork. So anyway, I didn't do it, but I had a bright idea, like, at the last minute. Because I think this was, like, I needed to do this assignment to move on or something. So I was like, now my man, Face Money right here, Alan, you know, he's African American, but you know people always said, what do you mix with? Because because of his hair or something, the way he looks, you know, how people in the black community talk about hair and stuff. They say, what do you mix with all the time? And so I had this bright idea to bring my boy Face Money, who was a rapper at the time. He was in a group with Freeway called Ice City. And Freeway was living with you at the time, I think. And so I brought my friend in, this rapper from North Philly, right, to Chestnut Hill to do. I said to the class, he's from Indonesia. I said, for my project, I went and got somebody from Indonesia, live in the flesh. And I told you, I said, before we went on, I said, yo, just remember, Jakarta is the capital of Indonesia. Jakarta, Jakarta, Jakarta. And so he gets up there. Now he's in the middle of this class in Chestnut Hill. And, you know, they start asking him questions. The kids are inquisitive. They're like, so what do you eat in Chestnut? What do you eat in Indonesia? And him, you know, he's like, yeah, I mean, we eat rice. Anyway, so it was hilarious. And we always laugh about that. And so I don't know if my teacher actually, I don't know if he went for it, but it was bold. It was bold and courageous, and he at least gave us props for that. And, you know, nobody, I mean, one girl was starting to ask too many questions. I was giving her the look. I was like, yo, don't ask another question. But yeah, I mean, so my friends knew, you know, my real friends knew, you know, you got friends and then you got associates, you know. He was a real friend, so he knew where I was and what I was doing. And he came to the school and was like, oh, this is cool. This is different. You know, it's different than the experiences that we had in other schools. So, yeah, but, you know, I was always, what I always wanted to do, I guess, is have a transparency between both. That's, you know, was always the goal, is to not be like, okay, I got to go to school and then I got to go home. Even though those environments were different, I wanted to kind of cross those boundaries and have it be just one thing so that, you know, who I am here is who I am there and vice versa. So that was always important to me. Yes, and then we'll come back here.
Hi, thank you. My name's Hannah. I also graduated from Krefeld.
Oh, nice.
And we grew up in very different environments. I went to Cheltenham High School before I dropped out and went to Krefeld. But when I heard you on the radio today talking about Kerouac, I was just like, yes, screaming, calling in. They were like, no, we have too many callers, because it's almost the same story. I mean, I read all of Kerouac's books, got kicked out of the library for reciting Allen Ginsberg, like, off, you know. And something that's I'm really connecting with your story is just this idea of like that guy on the street and connecting with your soul and bucking the system. So I kind of am curious now, besides your writing practice, what are some ways that you kind of gather your strength, get in touch with your soul, and continue your process of bucking the system, both personally and collectively?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think spending time with my family refreshes me. Being in nature, meditating, those kind of things just help me, like, rejuvenate. And then as far as bucking the system, you know, what I'm doing, one thing we did that's cool is we created a scholarship at that school. We created a scholarship there for kids who are interested in creative writing. And then I just mentor kids, you know what I mean? Kids in high school. I live in Baltimore as well as Chapel Hill, North Carolina. So there's a lot of kids in Baltimore that, you know, reach out to me and, you know, I mentor the kids and just try to show them a different, I have a rhyme where I say, and I write for young bucks in the ghetto, illustrating life on a higher level, teach them how not to settle through the treble, problem with authority, always been a rebel, rose from concrete, always been a pedal, saying fuck, fear and doubt, always been a devil. Anyway, so that's what I try to do is just kind of like show them through what I do another way and just give them and be real with them. You know, like one thing I love about my mom, and I talk about this in the book and even get in her, she's really real. Like she'll just keep it 100 with you, you know, all the time. Like I remember when I first started writing, I used to show my mom and she'd be like, no, just be like, no, this is just not good. Straight up. Like. So he always kind of just kept me going. But yeah, so those are some of the things I do. I want to get to all these questions. Let's go here. I saw your hand. Oh, and then we come here. My bad.
Is it true that you lived in Africa before you moved to the United States?
It's true. I was born in Zimbabwe. You know how in Belly, at the end of Belly, Nas is like, yo, I want to go to Africa. Well, my parents weren't just on some... Let's go to Africa. My parents were like, we are in Africa. We just moved here. You know what I mean? We've changed our names. We no longer go by European. My parents are completely about it when it comes to, you know, Africa and consciousness. So they moved to Africa in the 80s to be a part of the independence movement in Zimbabwe. And then we moved back to Philly like 83, 84, 85, something like that. Yeah, so I was born in Zimbabwe. I went back to Zimbabwe 2 years ago. I've been to Africa at this point because I've been going to Africa like pretty much every year for the last 10 years, a couple times. So I've been to like maybe 15 African countries at this point. But I love Africa. It's my heart. It's my heartbeat. I'm working on a big project right now that involves Africa and film and music and all this stuff. So, yeah, so Africa is my heart. Okay, yeah, we go here. Yeah.
So my name is April Evans, and I'll just sit down, sorry. I wanted to ask, how do you think we can confront mental health issues, especially with the inequities in the Black community, through works like Buck?
Okay, well, I think the beautiful thing about Buck is it opens up a dialogue and a discussion. And that's why my mom, she was like, you got to use these journal entries because Black people don't talk about this stuff. You know what I mean? We don't talk about it, and we don't talk about it seriously. So the first step is just opening up that dialogue and confronting it and realizing that it's really here. You know what I mean? When I first learned about mental health through my mom and just learning about and researching about depression and all these things, I came to a realization. I realized that most of the people that I grew up with had mental health issues. Like, I'm like, yo, everybody... Everybody in Omni and G-Town had something, like, you know what I mean? Like, it wasn't diagnosed, but all these cats is running around, manic, all types of stuff, and they're not being diagnosed. In certain white communities, it's more diagnosed. They're like, oh, I suffer from this, and I suffer from this, and I'm bipolar, and I this. It's all these different things that they have, you know what I'm saying? They know it. They know what they have, right? In the Black community, it's like, yeah, I mean, I'm cool. Like, no, you're not cool, brother. You got some stuff going on that we need to deal with. So it's. I think we open up the dialogue about it is the step one. It's just open up that dialogue, open up that discussion, being real about it, and not making light of it. Like, you know, a lot of times, and this is even in the book, my mom talks about her relationship with my dad and kind of his attitude toward mental health. And, you know, a lot of times we're like, you know, just get over it, basically, or just, you know, come on, like, what do you mean you're down? You know, it doesn't resonate. We don't really think that it's a health issue. We think it's just kind of like, you know, emotional or something, when it's really a chemical imbalance. So I think the first thing to do is just, what I wanted to do with the book is just open up that discussion. Let's talk about it. Let's be real about it. Let's not be afraid to confront it, and let's get people help. Let's talk about ways to, you know, with professionals to deal with these things. So I think step one is definitely, we got to talk about it, confront it head on. So that's what I wanted to do in Buck. It's all right there on the pages. Yes.
Good evening. My name is Jocelyn Johnson. And just as you wanted to thank your teacher, Debbie, I came here to thank you. Oh. As a freshman at Morgan, I almost did not pass my English class until you walked in there with It's Bigger Than Hip Hop. I didn't read a book, write a paper until it was time to read that book and that paper, and I haven't stopped since. I now have a degree in kinesiology and a minor in African American studies at Temple University.
That's what's up. That's great to hear. I appreciate that. I see here, and then we'll go over here. Wait for the mic, I think, because they're... Thanks.
I started reading your book, and then I heard you read some of the same passages, and I really hope that you will make a book on audio book on tape.
Hey, I got a great surprise. It's already out. The audio book is already out. It came out same day the book came out, so you guys can get that on Audible, iTunes, everything. It's available online. And you know, the audio book, that was really interesting to read. I read it myself, and I had an actress, Adamrele Ojo. She did my mom's letters because that's kind of a different tone. But I did all the voices, and it was an amazing experience actually doing that. And we're also doing the soundtrack to a book, which comes out in a couple months. And the soundtrack really marries like music with literature. So there's like readings from the book, excerpts from the book over music mixed with like hip hop. I just did a song with Talib Kweli recently. And so that, you know, just stuff like that. And different guest features are on it. And so it's a marriage between the music and the literature, just in the same way that it does on the page. Cool. Let's go back there. I see some hands. Let's go 1, 2.
Hi, my name's Alicia, and you said that you were a poet first, and I wanted to know exactly how did you negotiate like the transition between writing in poetry and then writing in prose, and then like how did you know how much poetry to like include in the novel without it sounding like too heavy-handed or over the top?
Yeah, well, you know, those are great questions. And by the way, what's up? She's a poet as well. But you know, for me, the poetry is first. That's kind of where I got. But for me, all these different mediums that I work in, whether it's film or music or writing or memoir or essays or whatever form of writing it is, it's all language arts. You know, it's like when you speak one language, let's say you speak Spanish, it's easier for you to pick up Portuguese because they have a lot of the same principles, right? And so you can pick up, and then the more languages you acquire, your capacity to learn new languages increases, right? And so you're able to pick up all these languages because your mind is working in a certain way. And so for me, all these different mediums, they're kind of the same to me in a way. Now, they all have their own rules and principles, but there's a connectivity that I see throughout all of them. I try not to overthink those kind of things. So I don't go in and think, well, how do I not be too poetic in this line? You know, with this kind of stuff, I really try to get to a space where, just like the blank page, where I'm completely free and it just flows out of me. I try to get to that place. Once I'm at that place, then we have a book. Before I get to that place, it's just a bunch of stuttered starts, and it's really a mental thing, and getting to a place where I can let those words and let that story flow out of me without thinking, right? Because when you think too much, it messes everything up. You know what I mean? So, yeah. Yep.
Hello, hi, my name's Maurice. I'm a second-year English teacher, and my question is, I'm kind of a little nervous because, you know, school's about to start, and I'm a little nervous about the curriculum, you know, because, you know, last year I tried to teach my kids Shakespeare, and 2 weeks into, you know, the process, the books turned up missing. So I guess my question is, How do you think from teaching this way of teaching?
Isn't that a good thing? You mean like they stole the Shakespeare books?
They didn't want to read them anymore, so they hid them. Oh. They hid the books.
I was like, yo, that's a good thing. You know what I mean? They're stealing the book. Okay, no, that's not a good thing.
So, you know, I'm trying to find ways to incorporate hip-hop, incorporate other types of books that relate to their culture. And I want to know, as a professor and as a poet, how does that engage your students, so to speak?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, like, when I told you my story, you know, it was reading something like Kerouac. And even then, that dude was writing in the 50s, and he was white, and he had a different experience than me. And even as I got older, I started to critique Kerouac, because Kerouac had some racial issues that I didn't like when I got older. But at that time, he connected with me because what he was writing about, and it related to me and what I was going through. And so I would definitely try to find works that relate to your students, you know what I'm saying? And things that they can identify with, you know, because, so it's definitely about finding things that engage them and keep them engaged. Because sometimes they'll get to Shakespeare, but it might be through MK. You know what I'm saying? So you have to kind of, one of the best compliments I ever received, this dude, he was a juvenile detention center. He ran at the juvenile detention center. And he said, I give your books and another guy's book, Sherman Alexie, who's also one of my favorite authors. He said, I give your books and Sherman Alexie books to kids who hate reading. And that just made me feel so good because I didn't like reading either back in the day. You know what I mean? And if I would have read something like this, it would have had the same effect as On the Road or something, where it's like, oh my God, you know, and then it leads you to, well, who does MK read? Oh, MK read The Alchemist. Okay, let me read The Alchemist. Okay, who does Paulo Coelho, who inspires him? Okay, well, let me go, read Tolstoy or whoever. And so you start to get this labyrinth of interconnectivity through literature, but it has to be introduced through something, right? You know what I mean? And so it's like when we were on the block shooting a trailer, somebody was out there talking about how they looked up Basquiat because they kept hearing Jay-Z talk about it. And, you know, we're on a block. These dudes they got introduced to this great contemporary artist through this rapper, right? But then once they found out about this guy, they're researching him. They're looking up, oh, did you know he did this and he did that, you know? So sometimes we just need that someone to introduce it properly, introduce us to that world, and then our minds can. So, yeah. I see one, two up there.
Two more.
Two more? Oh, okay. I might try to sneak three in. All right.
MK, thank you. I heard you this morning, and I was flabbergasted. I just had to come, so thank you.
Oh, appreciate you, man.
Question is, I work for a college as a recruiter, full-time job. The other day, I had this epiphany. I started trying to write a book. I write lyrics, do music. I said, I want to write and read and speak for the rest of my life. And so I've been on this journey on how to get there. So when I heard you on the radio, I pulled over literally in South Philly, was like, okay, wait, give me the time of day. So question is, how do I transition from full-time career with bills and notes to reading and writing and speaking literally for the rest of my life? I'm going to do it. I just don't know how. This one, I just need an answer. So thank you.
Yeah, well, it's great that you have the love for it. I think that's the first thing, having that passion, having that love for writing, for reading, you know, for speaking. That's the first thing. And I think, you know, honestly, just master your craft as much as possible. You know, read, write, keep working on your writing, you know. And then you'll get to a point at some point where you kind of have a decision to make, right? Where, you know, you can kind of make that decision. I'm, you know, I can't say quit your job and just do, you know, I don't want to be responsible for it, you know what I mean? You got bills, you know, I don't want you to be like, yo, MK told me that I don't need, so, you know, but you got to pursue what your heart is telling you to do. I mean, I'm all for that. My that's what my family comes from, that, you know, you have to do what your heart is telling you to do, but you have to be smart and strategic about it, I would say. You know, don't just walk in tomorrow like, I quit, you know what I mean? Like, who's coming with me? Because, you know, but... But, you know, unless that's what you need to do, you know what I mean? Only you really know what you need to do. But I would say the thing that's most important is you got to master that craft, right? You got to master your craft to really be able to make a living from doing it and that kind of thing. So study all the greats. You know, I always said, I play basketball, right? And I always play. Even when I talk about that in the book a little bit. You know, when I was younger, even when I was getting kicked out of school, the coaches were still giving me the keys to the gym and stuff. But I always said if artists and writers approach art and writing like athletes approach sports, you'll be thorough. Because athletes, you know, they wake up at 5 in the morning. They train. They do this. They do that. They're working constantly on their body, and their grind is incredible. I'm very inspired by the athlete's grind. And I feel like artists sometimes are a little bit too, you know, oh, I'll do it when I get inspired or whatever. But you have to really treat it like training. Like, I'm training for the Olympics right now. You know what I mean? So, yeah, so that's my advice. Cool. I got to sneak. I'm going to sneak her in real quick after that because she had her hand up for so long. Yeah.
Peace, brother. Thank you. You're kind of young to have memoirs, but I realize this isn't really like memoirs. You're just kind of capturing a snapshot. So I guess the question that I have is why this book now? And then I see it as very timely, and I wanted to know if you had a plan to get it into the hands of our youth, because there's youth that are doing, you know, the full spectrum. They have organizing like the Dream Defenders, but you also have groups of youth that are just kind of like letting the days go by. Mm-hmm. So do you have a plan to get the book into their hands? And then, you know, please speak on why this book, why now?
Definitely. Well, you know, first, in terms of the memoir, there's a difference between a memoir and an autobiography. Autobiography is comprehensive. It's your whole life, right? So I was born in this, and you go all the way up. A memoir is a snapshot. It is a period in time that you kind of focus on. So that's why I chose a memoir as a form, because that was also the transformational time in my life, the transformative time. Those years, 13 to 18, were like, you understand that about me, then you understand me now, right? And so I chose that. Definitely have a plan. I wrote this thinking about those young people that you're talking about across that spectrum. So we've got all types of plans to spread this throughout the country, different schools, different programs. So yeah, we're definitely, that's a big part of what we're doing. That's even why, you know, we have the visuals, you know what I mean, to engage young people. I got a crazy call from Don Cheadle last week. He wants to buy the movie rights, the TV rights. We're gonna be making a movie that I'm directing. Same thing, and you know, because again, it's a different language. It's like, oh, you don't read? Okay, I'll make a movie then. You know what I mean? Like, I want to make sure that you get this message. So we're gonna make a movie, and then I think why this book? Why now? You know, it was time. First of all, you need distance from something. For me, at least, before I can fully engage in writing about it. You know what I mean? So. I had enough distance where that I could write about it now, you know what I mean? And not be, it was uncomfortable to write it, honestly. And, you know, anyone who's written a book knows it's a tremendous struggle to write a book. You see me up here now, you know, I got lotion on, you know, I'm shining. But when I was writing this book, I was grimy, you know what I mean? I was on my grizzly, you know, wearing the same sweatpants for 3 weeks, you know what I mean? I was nasty looking. So, you know, it's a struggle to write a book. And, but I know, you know, for each thing that I've ever done artistically, it's not even a question. This is what I have to do now. It's like everything in front of me says, this is the story you have to tell, you must tell. And it's also the story that you're afraid of a little bit. It's whatever it is that kind of scares you a little bit, that you're fearful of, that's what I walk towards. Because that's where the real truth is, right? And so this was the thing that was like, oh, do I want to, you know, put myself out there like that? You know, let them know what we were doing in the 90s, you know, but because also I had enough time to become successful, I thought it was an important and inspirational story for so many young people that are going through it. You know what I mean? I think if I had tried to write the book immediately after prep, well, I hadn't done anything yet. I hadn't become a writer. I hadn't. So it was like, well, you know, what is this? You know, you're still. But now I had enough distance. I've seen enough things where it's like, Now I know my story can inspire not even just young people, but all people, you know what I mean? So different walks of life. And so it was this time, it just, everything in the universe told me to write this story. Talk to my mom, talk to my dad, talk to my brother. They said, write this story. So that's what it was. And then let's just squeeze in you one more real quick, and then we're wrap it up.
Hi, everyone. My name is Ceci.
Ceci, what's up?
Hey. I have a quick question. Who inspires you?
So many people inspire me, honestly. Your mom used to inspire me back in the day. Her mom was a friend of my family's. But so many people inspire me, just regular people, everyday walks of life. I just meet people like who just inspire me through, you know, I'm interested in the tenacity of the human spirit. And so I meet people all the time.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.